All right, welcome back. Just kicking it off. We're 2 minutes into our introductory period. Today we have Sean Kumar, which I'm super excited to have on. And Pray, thanks for being the admin as always. Pray Nadal, the MVP of Otter Labs, who's going to be recording, editing the show. Got some people rolling in. Another minute here while we get set up. One quick note, Sean, if you can hear me here, the Telegram. Yeah, you have to click that mute button.
Clicked it.
Nice. Let me double check here. Pray, are we live recording?
Yes.
We are. Fantastic. Sean, how are you?
Doing great.
Nice. I'm really excited. This is about our fifth episode. We run these on Friday afternoons, Argentinian time, which they're hour ahead of me in Boston, and people will be rolling in and out of the conversation listening, but we're going to be recording and then we'll post the show afterwards. So we usually keep it pretty short, 20-25 minutes. I'm really excited to chat with you. You and I work together quite closely, so I'm sure we'll have plenty of stuff to dive into. Most of the people listening will be developers in South America, but there's also other people that could be tuning in too. First thing, I want to just kick it off to you, Sean. Can you give a little background on what you're working on with Rhythm Z60?
Absolutely, yeah. Thanks for having me on, Mike. This is an exciting format to participate in. Rhythm 360, my background's in med tech on the service and sales and marketing side of things and some engineering of it on the product side. And I saw this big opportunity, which is sort of the last mile problem, which was all these great tools and devices that exist that can improve people's health, but there's that getting that information back to the getting it back to the clinicians in a way that they can use it, because just like everybody else, they're overwhelmed with too much data, and there's a needle in the haystack problem, and that's what we help solve, making these really complex things easier for clinicians to use. So I haven't seen the problem on the front lines. Was really what inspired it, and then we've been at it for about 15 months now, and having a lot of fun. And it's a big, hard problem too. I think healthcare, as you know, Mike, is a big, messy problem, and then COVID, obviously, on top of that, has changed things in a lot of ways. So it's a field that's catching up in some ways and doing things its own way in other ways.
Yeah, no, absolutely. One of the questions we asked ahead of time for folks that were going to be tuning in would be, or these are potential topics, the number one most popular response was how to turn from developer to founder. And I know you are technically the CTO. I don't know if you would describe yourself as a developer first, then to founder, but I'm curious, how did you go about starting a software company in the first place? How did you decide this is what you want to commit your life to and do for the next number of years? Was it a difficult process? Was it obvious to you? Do you have any advice for other developers who may be working on side projects they're thinking about going all in on? Yeah,
absolutely. Curious to hear your thoughts. Yeah, absolutely. My background in software was in undergrad, and even before that, I was coding primarily. Took a few classes, and then occasionally in engineering, I was a biomedical engineer, and occasionally we did some coding in the course for a project, mainly scripting. And I'd done some internships in software development. Then I went and basically did a different career path that was much more related to clinical engineering and biomedical engineering, but I always wanted to do software again. And so I was basically use this project as a way to get back into code, and wrote the original code on the project with a friend who was a much more established developer. And that was sort of, for me, really helpful, because as I was building a team out and building the project out, I really understood everything that was involved and the complexity, and was able to basically be a better project manager and build out a really big and good technical team. So I would say, if you're coming at it from a developer standpoint and you want to build your own business, you know, that's an interesting, you know, there you have the technical background, and now what you need is really management skills, really need to understand what makes businesses work and understand what your weaknesses are more than anything, and complement those with other people, and figure out what you want to learn, what you want to roll up your sleeves and learn, versus what you want to just sort of outsource or bring on expertise. In this case, I knew I really wanted to learn code and learn how projects really worked, all the way from soup to nuts. And so that's the part I rolled up my sleeves on. But now as the project's growing, I'm you know, delegating more of that and really doing more of the things a founder needs to do, which is really a lot less hands-on with those kinds of things, and you know, much more organizational, orchestrational kind of work.
How did you guys choose the initial technology? So you're sitting there with the concept, and you want to spin up a server, you want to get the website up. Presumably these are the first couple of steps. How did you decide what tech you're going to use? Because it's usually quite a long road you're on when you commit to different tech stacks.
That's actually a really good question. And it was a hard question for me to answer a few years ago, because, you know, knowing the stacks that were out there, you know, with Ruby on Rails and Django, and at the time too, with patient health data, understanding which infrastructures would allow us to grow really quickly without having to put a lot of work into doing compliance and infrastructural work. So first, really understood the laws around patient data. That was maybe a month or two of a research project. And then sort of scanning the marketplace for solutions that could solve that for us for a relatively affordable price. And then in terms of the actual stack, everything we do is Django in the back end. Then obviously it's JavaScript, but it's the Vue framework on the front end. And those were just conversations we had internally with the few people around at the time, looking at which of these were actively being developed. You know, at the time, Vue was pretty new, but there was a lot of enthusiasm in the developer community, and it seemed a little bit more lightweight and easier than some of the other frameworks. I don't know if we'd make that same decision if we started over today. Django as a backend has been very good for us. And that was sort of just poking around, seeing library support. One of the things we thought would be useful was to have Python as our language, because we thought there was a big data play here. But, you know, and given the amount of libraries in Python around data science, I don't think it matters that much anymore. You know, looking back on it, if we had gone with another framework, Node or something like that, I think we'd be fine. I do think sometimes in terms of finding people that know your framework, we found interesting regional variances. Obviously, Node has gained a lot of popularity globally. And so I think there's probably more developers that you could find that do Node. But at the end of the day, you're looking for just people who are really good at software development and can pick up frameworks and are not intimidated by learning new frameworks.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. It is kind of a balance with what's on the bleeding edge, you know, what's kind of older school technology. Like, I think of PHP as being widely adopted, and there's a new Laravel, not new, but Laravel framework makes PHP more relevant and useful today. But Node and React Native, Vue, it's interesting how I remember even a couple years ago, I was listening to this software tech podcast. I think it was the 37 Signals team with Basecamp, and they were talking about how Ruby on Rails, which one of the founders contributed to or built the first version of, he was saying that, you know, we have a big advantage in the market and being a software tool SaaS company, and that we're using Ruby on Rails, and the Ruby on Rails is the state of the art. And now Ruby, I would say Ruby on Rails is 5-10% of what I see. It's not nearly as popular as it once was. So it's kind of like a constant evolution of what technologies are useful, which is probably a really good thing, because that keeps startups always competitive. You know, as your company grows 5-10 years from now, there'll be another technology, maybe not so much in healthcare, but in consumer tech that has a unique advantage to it. It's faster. It allows people to do something different. Even Telegram right now, the fact that we can just hop on and publish this live, even they have video coming out soon. You know, everyone could tune in, tune out. It's like, it's pretty technical. It's a pretty difficult product to build.
I agree. It felt like it was a really stressful decision at the time, but in retrospect, it probably wasn't. And yeah, you know, I've been tracking Ruby on Rails too, DHH, right? Mm-hmm. He's one of the co-founders of that operating system. And we had a lot of engineers say to us, this is the best thing. It's so quick. You can stand it up so quickly, you know, and do a lot of damage really quickly. And I think that's probably true. But then obviously, you know, that doesn't solve everything for you. Those kinds of decisions. So it's a tough one, but I think it's also probably something not to spend too much time on and go with kind of what you know, and knowing that the legacy cost will always be there for whatever you choose.
Yeah. One thing I want to shift gears and ask you about is would you consider yourself a solo founder, or is there someone that you work close enough with to call a founder?
No, I'm a solo founder. Not really by choice. It's hard to find a good founder. I have a friend here in San Francisco who is part of like a founder dating match program, you know, and it was really funny to hear about him talk about that, because basically you do these one-on-ones and you try to find a founder, and he went through that whole process and he didn't find anybody. He actually said that it was easier finding a wife than it was finding a co-founder.
Wow.
I think if you have a co-founder or co-founders, that's an advantage. Obviously there are advantages to being a solo founder with making quick decisions and all of that. But, I have leaned on a lot of advisors and have gotten really good advisors. Probably about three to six months into the project, I really started getting higher quality advisors that were quite a godsend. So, the solo founder thing is, now as we're building out more of a C-suite executive leadership team, it's going to make things a lot better on a day-to-day basis in terms of making decisions is probably what.
Yeah, I think you're probably being humble here too, because I know being a solo founder, I've never done it. And I just imagine that the challenge has got to be climbing Mount Everest, you know, with no oxygen in shorts and a t-shirt. Much more difficult.
Yeah, there's moments like that where you just really feel like, man, it'd be nice to have someone to lean on, you know. And what happened was, people on the team, your early employees, you start to just treat them that way, you know. And so that's kind of what happened, Mike. But I'd mm-hmm. probably take your approach. I know that you've had a lot of great co-founders over the years, and you know, that seems like a more optimal approach.
Mm. Yeah. A big part of what we want to do at Otter is to invest in developers, you know, nurture them in the sense that we connect them to great companies. But if they have that itch where they want to go start a company, I think capital is pretty consolidated in the US. You know, US investors tend to focus on US companies. And I think nowadays it's not so much the case for founder potential. So people listening that want to start companies, we did a poll, and I think something like 30% of people out of our 800 folks in the group have side projects that they think could potentially turn into startups one day. And so I think there's a renaissance of sorts, like an explosion of tech companies that they're going to come from all over the world. And I think Argentina is just a great country to believe that there's going to be a lot of successes out of there.
That's great.
Are there companies that you look at and you think, this is the type of company I want to build, either from the way that the customer experience is like, or the design of the product, or management team philosophy? Do you look at any companies in particular? And if so, what do you pull from them and extract as being particularly valuable?
That's a really great question. Once you start building your own thing, you're constantly analyzing every interaction with every other company, right? Especially from an onboarding and customer success standpoint. Those are really the two key things, I think, to scalability. I would have to say, thinking through this, I mean, there's companies that I find difficult to deal with. Let's start with that, like Google, and Amazon, and like that. Support is a little bit harder to get, even for basic admin things, like in their workspace enterprise solutions for small businesses. And then there's others, you know, I find like our payroll software, we use Gusto, find them to be quite good and sort of on top of things. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm constantly looking at how people set up support, customer support, how they do documentation, how they get people to use, you know, sort of more documentation and things like that. I think that's a big challenge. And I'm not sure if I know of a company that's really done a good job of that or solved it in a way. Because it's so hard to get people to, especially in healthcare, and this may be a domain specific thing, but we find that our users are really overwhelmed and stressed out and don't often like sort of immediate answers. Who doesn't like an immediate answer, right? But I find that to be one of our challenges that we're thinking through and looking for good examples. I mean, I think Amazon is at least for not on the AWS side, but on the consumer side, does an awesome job with customer support. And that consumer brand is just so vast and easy to use that it's, you know, been a crazy growth business.
Yeah. It's kind of, when you take a step back and think about it, it's unbelievable how good they are for how big they are. You know, the ability to hop into a live chat on their website, you know, 6 different ways to contact them, interacting with probably 50 different languages. It's mind blowing, but they, you know,
really?
they get paid for it. They I think doubled their valuation in the last year over COVID. So it's, they're well appreciated for their success.
That customer focus that they have is just so incredible, you know?
Yeah.
Writing stuff off if they made a mistake or you made the mistake, you know, but really trying to hold on to the long-term customer value, which for them, lifetime value is obviously pretty high. They've figured that out.
Yeah, I know one anecdote on this is that Jeff Bezos has said that whenever they have board meetings or important executive meetings, he puts an empty chair in the room to represent the voice of the customer, which I thought was at first kind of silly, but when you think about it, you really need to think about what's best for the company, for the customer, like consciously as a part of your debate. It's not, you know, there's sometimes, especially as you grow large, there could be a conflict of interest. I think in healthcare, this is particularly relevant when you see large healthcare companies. What are they doing? Are they, if say you start a company hypothetically solving ADHD, you know, you focus on ADHD. Well, what if you solve the problem, there's no market opportunity. You know, it's like you can't quite, when healthcare companies scale, they're at sort of a conflict with like, hey, we want to grow the market size. So that means if everyone's healthy, we have no market. So there's almost, and I think the United States is particularly falling victim to this because we have just such inflated healthcare systems. I don't know what the answer is, but it's ultimately the people have to, I believe, have the power to choose what products they want to buy in the market.
Absolutely. And we get the, I was actually on a call this morning. We bill insurance companies, and some of our patients, you know, don't know what's going on. And what we find is that there's a lot of passing the buck, you know, and people, never really leave satisfied. And so that's just sort of been ingrained in how the healthcare system works. Cause there's so many intermediaries involved. You can always just point the finger, at some, well, you call your insurance company, call the hospital, right? Like there's a lot of that. And I think that's probably the biggest frustration with it. And so that's you take the Amazon model, right, and you apply that into healthcare and you really focus on who are the customers, the patients. I think that you need to have the faith there that the lifetime value is really high for doing something like that, which is kind of not how it works, you know, is putting my hat on as a patient, right? When I interact with the healthcare system, I don't really get that from everybody involved, maybe like 20% of the people in the ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a good segue. I was going to ask you, tell for people listening, what would it be like to work at Rhythm Science or Rhythm 360? What do you view as the unique attributes of the culture or what would get somebody excited to want to jump into your team?
I would say that basically at the core of this is a lot of people that really understand the pain points for patients. And doctors. And so taking that in mind and making that our driving mission at the company really helps make the work really meaningful, because we know that we're actually solving these problems and having an impact on physician, nurse, and patient, like the quality of their days, and for the patients, it could be the quality of their life, you know? And so that kind of meaningful aspect of this, I think is something that working here, everybody feels that way. And, you know, we remind each other, even if you're on not exactly customer facing, you'll see that feedback come through from the customers, and good or bad. And that really motivates us to think about, to get the design right, to get the logic right, to get, you know, to do things the right way, but also sustainable way, because we're a healthcare company. We're also recognizing, you know, that there's a lot of problems with burnout, a lot of problems with, you know, just being an employee these days that are bad for your health. Right. And so we try to dog feed our product in that sense, and, you know, make sure that people are working together well in a healthy way, and also collaborating with each other and communicating, so that we know, you know, and that's one of the hard things with remote work too, right? Is making sure there's communication around those other aspects that are a lot easier when you're in person, to know if somebody's, you know, overwhelmed or stressed out and needs help, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely requires a lot more intentional communication. You know, you're not just going to pass somebody in the hallway the way you would in person.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah. Sometimes you got to check in, and that's the culture we try to foster, where there is a lot of communication. And that way we know if you work in an office, you can find somebody, you know, in the bathroom that's, you know, whatever, like crying or something, right? How do you do that remotely? How do you create that kind of culture? And then also how do you make it really goal oriented, where people feel really accomplished that we've achieved a lot? And I think that's really picking the right people, but also fostering really good collaboration.
Well, Sean, I really have a huge amount of respect for everything you've done and the direction you guys are going. I know you have a lot of exciting news, a lot of exciting things to be working towards. And yeah, thank you for jumping on and spending the time to chat with us.
My pleasure. Really, really fun, Mike. Thank you for having me.
All right, my man. Well, take care, and onward and upward.
Sounds good. Thanks, Mike. Bye.
Bye.